major U.S. airbase in western Iraq comes under a drone strike hours after a rocket attack on another U.S. base in Baghdad. A senior Hamas leader says the group only displayed half of its strength during the recent fighting with Israel, warning that any future war will reshape the region. And the U.S. president says Washington will not hesitate to respond to Russia's, quote, future harmful activities ahead of the summit with his Russian counterpart. Appreciate you being with us. First story takes us to Iraq this hour, where a major U.S. military base in the western Iraqi province of Anbar has been targeted by drones, the second such attack on the facility in just over a month. The Iraqi army says two drones were used in the attack on Ain al-Assad Air Base, adding that the UAVs were shot down by a U.S. military air defense system. Hours earlier, a rocket was also shot down above a U.S. base at the Baghdad airport. U.S. bases in Iraq have come under increasing rocket and drone attacks amid rising tensions over the continued American military presence in the Arab country. Anti-U.S. sentiments escalated following the U.S.'s assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Mohandas in January of 2020. A senior leader of the Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, says the group only displayed half of its strength during the recent fighting with the Israeli regime.
We showed only half our strength. We managed to launch 130 rockets on Tel Aviv in one barrage, and we only launched our old rockets in the last campaign.
Yahya Sinwar reiterated that the Palestinian resistance emerged victorious during last month's fighting. He also warned that any future war with Israel will reshape the region. Palestinian resistance groups dealt severe blows to Israel during the regime's 11-day aggression by firing 4,300 rockets. Israeli media say the massive rocket fire pushed Tel Aviv to beg the U.S. to mediate a ceasefire. Meanwhile, Gaza's health ministry says 253 Palestinians lost their lives in the Israeli offensive, including 66 children, and nearly 2,000 others were wounded. U.S. President Joe Biden has accused Russia of posing challenges to Europe's security, saying Washington will stand with its European allies against Moscow. Biden also underlined that the U.S. will not hesitate to respond to what he called Moscow's future harmful activities. The U.S. president made the comments as he is set to meet his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, later this month. Biden has ramped up pressure on Russia since taking office in January. In March, he likened Putin to a killer, which drew fierce criticism in Russia. The two countries are at odds over a range of issues. These include the Ukraine crisis and claims of the Kremlin's interference in the U.S. presidential election. Author and researcher Greg Simons believes allegations leveled against Russia by the U.S. are just a political game.
Well, I mean, this is just an example of business as usual, if we want to speak. So the continuation of this Russiagate, I mean, if you break it down, it's basically what you have this phrase or the slogan, to accuse your opponent that of which you are guilty. And it's a political game because the US as a global hegemony is on the wane, and they're trying to keep their hegemony by what I would call obstructive foreign policy. Then they can try to justify what would be otherwise unjustifiable. If things were harmonious relations, then you have no need to have this extraordinary circumstance. And when you have an extraordinary circumstance, you can circumvent the conventional and agreed upon rules of international relations, which he's trying to do, to limit Russia's strengths and opportunities by increasing its weaknesses and threats, and thereby keep the US contextually in a stronger position.
A delegation of three U.S. senators has arrived in Taiwan's capital, Taipei, a move that is expected to spark an outcry from China. The senators, two Democrats and one Republican, say their trip is aimed at giving 750,000 doses of COVID-19 vaccines to Taiwan. Democratic Senator Tammy Duckworth says the visit highlights Washington's bipartisan support for Taipei. Taiwan's President Tsai Ing-wen has thanked the senators for delivering what she calls lifesavers to her country. Taiwanese Foreign Minister Joseph Wu has accused China of causing trouble for Taiwan and getting international aid to combat the pandemic. China considers Taiwan as its own territory and has already rejected similar charges leveled by the self-ruled island. However, China has criticized Japan for a recent donation of more than 1 million AstraZeneca doses to Taiwan. Independent China strategist Andrew Leung says the United States is using Taiwan as its unsinkable aircraft carrier.
Taiwan is the United States' unsinkable aircraft carrier in a 360 degrees pushback against China. And that posture is bipartisan. Biden administration Secretary of State Antony Blinken recently said, America's relations with China must be competitive when it should be, collaborative when it can be, and adversarial when it must be. Now, all these sound like a kind of very smart kind of tactics, sometimes described by the Biden administration as smart garden high fence, as distinct from the earlier 360 degrees pushback against China. Regardless, there is not really a credible China strategy in the sense that the United States is not prepared to give up the so-called One China policy, because this would immediately trigger a war over Taiwan. But on the other hand, I think that Beijing is taking this in its stride. Unless the United States is formally supporting independence, otherwise this is part of the kind of great power rivalry.
Well, Iran has condemned the UN decision to temporarily revoke Tehran's voting rights in the General Assembly over its dues to the world body. Tehran argues that it's paid its dues to the world body regularly, and it's the economic sanctions that have made payments increasingly difficult for the country.
Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has strongly condemned a United Nations decision to strip Tehran of its voting rights in the UN General Assembly.
This decision is fundamentally flawed, entirely unacceptable, and completely unjustified, as Iran's inability to fulfill its financial obligation toward the United Nations is indirectly caused by unlawful unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States to punish those who comply with the Security Council resolution.
In a letter to the UN chief, Zarif said, taking away Iran's voting privileges violates the UN Charter and the spirit of sovereign equality of member states. He said Iran failed to pay its dues because of extreme conditions imposed by the U.S. on its banking relations. Zarif stressed that Washington's, quote, economic terrorism has faced Iran with difficulty buying food and medicine, let alone paying its UN fees. He accused the United States of attempting to mass starve Iranian people and condemned the United Nations' inaction on anti-Iran sanctions. Zarif noted that nevertheless, his country remains committed to settling its arrears.
The UN should totally understand Iran's position. It's been sanctioned by the worst international sanctions ever imposed on a nation, arguably, in the modern era. And yet the United Nations has obviously religiously decided to ignore the realities and the circumstances of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Of course, it goes deeper than this. The United Nations relies on the US of A for its funds. The majority of the funds that keep the United Nations going come from America. And of course, they're based primarily in the US as well. It's a misnomer to imagine that the UN is independent.
In the meantime, Iran maintains that it has always paid its dues to the international body, despite the sanctions.
Well, the UN says Iran needs to pay over $16.2 million to have its voting rights restored. Now, this is while under Article 19 of the UN Charter. The General Assembly has the authority to determine whether the failure to pay the dues has been beyond the country's control, in which case it can allow the country to continue to vote. Considering that the sanctions against Iran have been one of the most severe against any nation, why hasn't the world body given Iran a waiver on its voting rights?
The spokesman for Iran's foreign ministry says the country has regularly paid its UN membership contributions during the past years, despite unilateral sanctions imposed by the United States on Tehran, which have made financial transactions difficult for the Islamic Republic. Saeed Khatibzadeh said Tehran has been in talks with the UN Treasury to settle the debt. He also urged the world body to introduce a self-transaction channel after the US blocked the previous channels used by the Islamic Republic to transfer money. The foreign ministry spokesman said Iran has proposed using its frozen assets in South Korea to pay off the arrears. He said the United Nations Secretariat is completely aware of the details of the issue, which he said was not Iran's fault whatsoever. According to a statement by the UN General Assembly, as of 21st of May 2021, five member states are subject to provisions of Article 19 of the Charter, including Iran and the Central African Republic.
Nothing is being left unturned, no stone is being left unturned to make Iran bow. Islamic Republic of Iran is arguably one of the last nations still not to be part of the Bank of International Settlements, if you like, subjugated sovereign powers. There's a running theme. Those who control those institutions and have those levers of power don't want Iran to succeed in any way, because the Islamic Republic of Iran stands for a set of principles, primarily Islamic principles, but humanitarian principles and real principles of justice and fairness.
This is while the same article allows an exception for member states that can demonstrate that conditions beyond their control contributed to their inability to make payments. But the world body has so far rejected Iran's argument that the impact of the sanctions prevented Tehran from paying off its arrears.
The seven candidates for Iran's upcoming presidential vote have attended a televised debate. It's the first out of three presidential debates which center on the economy. Yusuf Jalali reports.
After days of campaigning for the upcoming presidential vote in Iran, candidates now stand toe-to-toe for a face-off. On Saturday, the seven runners attended the first televised debate, which was aired live on national television. Themed with economy, the first debate required the candidates to answer common questions ranging from monetary policies to domestic production and boosting exports.
In order to boost domestic production, we need to reduce the taxes levied on our producers and in return increase the taxes on unproductive businesses such as real estate or forex trading.
8 years ago, in the same place, I showed you a 10,000 rial banknote and warned you that if the current trend went on, our national currency would collapse. We need to take a different approach than using people's pockets to solve the government's problems.
We have prepared a package that consists of 213 projects. 51 of them are focused on harnessing inflation and controlling the prices.
When we speak about eliminating poverty, we're not just talking about basic rights, but it's also about entertainment and health policies. I have a comprehensive plan that can tackle these issues.
We need to turn our focus toward a 500 million strong market that exists in the region and not our 80 million strong domestic market. I mean, we need to strengthen our regional diplomacy and open up to the world to attract investment.
The debate started with random questions to each of the candidates, but got raucous after Abdel Nasser Hemmati picked on the other contenders, saying they're running to promote poverty rather than wealth.
Unlike the other candidates, I don't like to resort to lying to attract more votes. None of them is speaking of the distribution of wealth, but increasing poverty. I will pay equal attention to both creating wealth and its fair distribution.
Hemmati's comment was not left unanswered, as Alireza Zakani lashed out at him by reminding him of his poor performance as the head of the Central Bank of Iran, blaming him for the unprecedented devaluation of the national currency, the rial, which is currently traded at 240,000 against the U.S. dollar.
You have dealt an irreparable blow to the national currency, yet you accuse us of spreading poverty. You have already increased poverty during your tenure, while I speak of national production and boosting it. So please stop making accusations.
There are still two debates to go. The second and third debates will take place on Tuesday and Saturday, respectively, which will investigate the candidates' cultural and political policies.
Well, the debate offers an opportunity for each of the candidates to try to stand out and make the best impression to voters. It also gives a chance to the public to weigh up all the choices in one go. Yet, it's still too soon to judge about who stands a better chance to win the race, since the rivalry is still on. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
And with Yusuf's report brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Thank you all so much for staying with us.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on June 4, 2014, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of the demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini. The speech was delivered at Imam Khomeini's shrine.
As for the first part, the reality that I referred to is that 25 years have passed from the demise of our great Imam, Rahmatullah Alayh. But people's enthusiasm and excitement to hear and know about him has not diminished. And this is not particular to our country. Rather, this reality exists in the world of Islam and even beyond that. Not only in our country, where the third generation of revolution is growing and blossoming, but also in the entire world of Islam, the youth of the age of communications and internet are after gaining more information about the issues of the revolution, about the Islamic Republic, and about the architect of this great structure. And these youths can easily familiarize themselves with these issues which occur far away from their own environment. The phenomenon of religious democracy and the theory of Vilayat-e Faqih are issues which are significant and attractive for the intellectual environments of the world of Islam.
Allah, Allah, Allah.
first days, our enemies began making a comprehensive effort, and the more we moved forward, the more comprehensive this effort became. They used hundreds and thousands of televisions, radio stations, and internet sites to abuse the Islamic Republic, its great founder, and its supporters. Of course, this issue has been helpful to us because it has aroused the curiosity of listeners and viewers throughout the world. These listeners and viewers want to know the reason behind all these enmities, hostilities, and mudslinging. They want to know the nature of the truth, which has been the target of these enmities. So our enemies mentioned our names, and they spoke about Imam Rahmatullah Alayh and our system with the purpose of showing their enmity. But surely they will scheme, and I too will scheme. The Holy Quran, chapter 86, verse 15 and 16. This is what Allah the Exalted says. They started this widespread movement with such an intention, but it eventually created an opportunity for us because the sense of curiosity of the listeners to these stations was aroused throughout the world. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
After a brutal assault that lasted almost 2 weeks and killed hundreds of Palestinians, a truce has been agreed between Hamas and the Israeli occupation to bring the May war to a ceasefire. Both sides claim victory, but victory means different things to each of them. So let's take a closer look. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. After 11 days of Israeli airstrikes and bombardment of the Gaza Strip, an Egyptian brokered ceasefire came into effect on May 21st at 2 a.m. local time. Since then, the ceasefire has largely held, even though Israel continued to bomb Gaza right up until the last minute. All in all, 12 Israelis were killed. Meanwhile, 250-plus Palestinians, almost half of them women and children, were slaughtered by Israel in the most vicious war since the ground invasion in 2014. Despite the agreement to a ceasefire, the very next day, Israel continued to tear gas Palestinians at the Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem. Israeli forces had stormed the very same mosque, which is the third holiest site in Islam, just 12 days before, which ignited the war in the first place. In addition, Israel also continued its brutality through mass arrests targeting Palestinians who were protesting and raiding their houses even. The whole point of Palestinians rallying and marching in the streets was that they wanted an end to the occupation. They wanted to live in peace and to be rid of this oppression. Instead, the Israelis respond with increased brutality and disproportionate violence. Even in a delicate situation just like this, the Israelis double down and continue to desecrate the Aqsa Mosque and to treat Palestinians like less than human. This is what the Israeli occupation is, oppression. The Israelis have long used disproportionate force as a standard practice in their tactics. This is known as the Dahiya Doctrine, named after a neighborhood in the Lebanese capital, Beirut, which was completely decimated in the 2006 war. Israel then implemented this doctrine of disproportionate violence against Palestinians during its war in Gaza in 2009, 2014, and now again in 2021. This is a practice that actually dates further back to the days of the first Zionist paramilitary groups in Palestine who would kill Arabs, British troops, and even non-Zionist Jews. Gaza has a population of 2 million Palestinians who live in a tiny enclave which is completely cut off from the rest of the world and subject to a blockade by Israel and Egypt since 2007. The resources are already extremely limited, and Gaza has been rightfully dubbed the world's largest open-air prison. It's extremely important to underline the brutality that Israel employs against Palestinians on a regular basis and who is behind it. Just in the span of 11 days, we saw Israel completely decimate Gaza's water, electricity, and health infrastructure. Gaza has 10 electricity lines that deliver power to its residents. Israeli shelling caused 6 of them to go offline. The spokesperson for Gaza's power distribution plant said that residents are now getting maybe 5 hours of electricity a day, as opposed to 12 hours before the attack. Hundreds of thousands of people in Gaza had their water supply cut off when a desalination plant was put out of action. The water system was damaged so badly that human waste and sewage began overflowing onto the streets. Israel continued to strike health facilities, hospitals, and clinics. One of Gaza's most important doctors, Dr. Abu Alouf, worked at Al-Shifa Hospital, which is the biggest in Gaza, and taught other medical students. He was killed by an Israeli airstrike at his home, along with 12 other members of his family. Several other Palestinian families were also completely wiped out. And speaking of Al-Shifa Hospital, Israel damaged roads leading there, which made it harder for victims and the wounded to be treated in the first place. The only clinic able to carry out COVID-19 testing in Gaza was damaged, as were several other government clinics and clinics belonging to NGOs. And after all, this is nothing new, as we've seen Israel purposely kill medical staff, doctors, and nurses in the past. Just a few months ago, Israel was blocking vaccines from entering Gaza and only inoculating Jewish settlers in the West Bank and Jerusalem. This is another form of oppression, and we have to call it for what it is, a medical apartheid. And as a result of the latest strikes on Gaza, the UN reported that 50 schools were damaged, which impacted over 40,000 children, according to Save the Children and UNRWA, the Palestinian Refugee Agency. 47,000 people have been pushed to use schools as shelters, and schools still remain closed. Israel also bombed the offices of the international press, leveling a 12-story building that used to house the offices of Al Jazeera and the Associated Press. And this is once again something that Israel does regularly. It targets journalists on purpose, Palestinian and non-Palestinian alike, because it doesn't want people to document its crimes. The situation in Gaza was already bad enough from previous wars, so bad that many things damaged in 2014 and before that have still not been rebuilt to begin with, making the effects of further Israeli aggression even more apparent. Officials in Gaza have estimated that reconstruction will cost millions of dollars and take years. Gaza's Public Works and Housing Ministry told OCHA that nearly 17,000 residential and commercial units were either damaged or completely destroyed. Around 80,000 people have either lost their homes or had their homes damaged, according to Al Jazeera. And when it comes to casualties, once again, the death toll is incomparable. The vast majority of casualties are Palestinians. In less than 2 weeks, Israel massacred 244 Palestinians. Half of those were women and children. In contrast, 12 Israelis were killed. These figures illustrate the imbalance and ruthlessness of the Israelis. According to the UN, 5,591 Palestinians have been killed versus 251 Israelis in the years between 2008 and 2020. The number of injured is also extremely disproportionate. So why is it that there are so many Palestinians killed, and why are so many of them civilians? Do the Israelis not know where their bombs are landing? Do the Israelis not know where their shells are going? Of course they do. In 2018, the Israeli occupation forces even bragged about this on Twitter, saying, quote, "We know where every bullet landed." This was during the Right to Return marches, when Palestinians were gathering at the border fence to protest, demanding to return to their homes and the homes of their parents and grandparents after they had been kicked out during the Israeli takeover and ethnic cleansing in 1948. Israel purposely shot Palestinians in the knees, killed medical staff, killed journalists, and then bragged about it. And here once again in 2021, we have a disproportionate amount of casualties on the Palestinian side, and not just casualties, but damage and destruction to public and health facilities. This is a war crime, a brazen war crime under the Geneva Convention. Israel kills 20 times more Palestinians, destroys their homes, destroys their infrastructure with overwhelming firepower, and then claims victory while also pretending it's a victim at the same time. And who is behind all this? The West, of course. The West not only gives Israel weapons and logistical support, but also political protection. After all, the United Kingdom helped create Israel when it issued the Balfour Declaration in 1917, promising a Jewish homeland in Palestine. In 1947, it gave up its mandate and left, allowing the United Nations to carve up Palestine and give Palestinians a mere 50% of their land. And Zionist militias consequently took over, and here we are. And ever since, the United States has provided weapons and other material support. Since World War II, Israel is the largest cumulative recipient of foreign aid from the U.S. Just in 2016, under Barack Obama, Israel received a $38 billion package in military aid over 10 years. That means every single year, the United States gives Israel $3.8 billion to continue bombing and killing Palestinians. Even amid all this violence, and Israeli forces desecrating Al-Aqsa Mosque, brutalizing protesters, bombing Gaza, U.S. President Joe Biden goes ahead and approves a weapons sale to the Israelis worth $735 million. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Joining me is Max Blumenthal, journalist and editor at The Gray Zone. Thanks for coming on, Max. It's good to have you on the program.
Thanks for having me, Richard.
So, Max, I wanted to start out with this recent onslaught on Gaza. U.S. Secretary of State Blinken, British Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab, you know, they both visited Netanyahu. They're doing this kind of victory lap now. And you had all these countries groveling over Israel, just tripping over themselves to see who can support Israel the hardest. I mean, what do you make of that? Right, their support during the 11-day attack, especially from Western countries.
Well, the Biden administration entered office assuming that the Abraham Accords, the normalization of Israel with the monarchic colonial cutout states, and Jared Kushner's deal of the century were fully intact, completely safe, and that the Palestinian question or the Palestinian struggle could be put in the icebox. And they were proven wrong by this massive surge of resistance we saw across historic Palestine. Biden was forced to deal with Netanyahu, a figure who he is not necessarily sympathetic to, but this is one of the most pro-Israel former senators in the history of the Senate. And so his natural instinct was to give Israel the time it wanted. As Israel failed militarily and its domestic situation became destabilized, the Biden administration panicked. They began pushing for a ceasefire. And now we see Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State, having flown to Jerusalem in the Holy Land, a place he and the Biden administration did not expect him to be at this juncture. And the program that he is offering is so out of date and out of touch with the reality on the ground. It is another call for a two-state solution and more humanitarian aid to the people of Palestine without dealing with Hamas and more weapons for Israel. It's the same formula we've seen since the Clinton administration. So the Biden administration is stuck in 1996. And meanwhile, Hamas is at the peak of its credibility after demonstrating its deterrence capacity in this conflict, something the Biden administration and its vassals in the UK and EU are unwilling to reckon with.
And when you say Israel's military failure and that Hamas demonstrated this deterrence capability, could you maybe expand on that? Because both the Israelis and Hamas, they're both claiming victory, right? But there seems to be a clear winner here, and not just militarily at least, but I would also say in public opinion.
Well, in terms of public opinion, the clear victor is Hamas. And this escalation occurred right after Mahmoud Abbas, the sort of permanent ruler of the West Bank cantons and collaborator with the Israeli security forces, had postponed indefinitely the Palestinian Legislative Council elections. So Hamas not only showed itself to be a representative of the Palestinian polity, but also a defender of Jerusalem and the Al-Aqsa Mosque, the third holiest site in Islam. So as far as the political metrics, Hamas appears to be the clear winner. Militarily, each side measures its victory in a different way. Israel obviously can destroy much more, but this escalation was not a war that can be looked at in isolation. It's a part of a series of wars that have occurred since the siege of Gaza began in 2005. And so it's a protracted war, and in each escalation, Hamas and the armed factions in the Gaza Strip, Islamic Jihad, PFLP, have demonstrated their ability to improve their capacity to strike deeper into Israeli territory. This time, Hamas broke out of Gaza, actually affected the situation in Jerusalem, and broke through Israel's Iron Dome, striking targets. It orchestrated set-piece attacks over Tel Aviv, something we've never seen before. It cleared the frontiers of Gaza from Israeli military equipment vehicles with its Cornet anti-tank guided missiles. It terrified the Israeli military to the point where Israel faked a ground invasion, something that had gone fairly wrong during the last assault on Gaza in 2014. And it outsmarted Israel when Israel attempted to trick Hamas leadership and Hamas military leadership into going into bunkers and the tunnel system under Gaza City by not falling for that feint. So Israel's major military maneuver actually failed. What Israel achieved turned out to be the destruction of civilian towers, which, as an Air Force pilot revealed, was just an act of frustration, a ventilation of the bloodlust of Israeli society, and the killing of many families, removing entire families from the civil registry through massacres. This was Israel's military achievement, and this speaks to another political failure of Israel, or connects to another political failure of Israel we can discuss more in length, which is its loss of the global opinion battle.
Just recently, Egypt has invited Hamas, the PA, and Israel for peace talks, you know, to try and forge a more sustainable truce. What do you think of that? What do you think the outcome of that is going to be?
In each case, Israel has refused to offer anything directly to Hamas and has worked through Egypt, which is emerging more and more as a broker between Hamas and the West, and Qatar. And the agenda has always been that Qatar will inject enough money to keep the status quo going, and slowly Hamas will be domesticated. And that's what Israel believed had happened in the past 7 years, and Hamas demonstrated that that was not in the cards whatsoever. So I think we're going to see more demands from the governors of the Gaza Strip, and they're going to make those demands not just based on the removing the siege from Gaza or improving conditions in Gaza, but also they will be related to the home thefts in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of East Jerusalem. They will be related to the status quo around the Al-Aqsa Mosque. They'll be related to the overall occupation. And that is going to be a new development. And we saw Yahya Sinwar, the prime minister of the Gaza Strip, deliver a press conference in front of the public and then declare to the Israeli military that he was walking home, walked through the Gaza City and said, if you want to find me, I will be at home, daring them to assassinate him as he was a top target during this escalation. He understands that Hamas has deterred Israel to the point that they will not be assassinating him in the near future.
Yeah, it's quite an astonishing victory. It's quite a shift from what we've seen before. And, you know, just lastly, Max, I saw you wrote this article in the Gray Zone, you know, about this this PR campaign where they're trying to portray pro-Palestinian supporters as anti-Semitic. You know, I was wondering if you wanted to expand on that or tell us a bit more about it.
Well, it was inevitable that the Israel lobby in the U.S. after this massive political defeat, after seeing just this unprecedented surge of Palestine solidarity activism in the streets, with protests in places we've never seen protests before, like Pensacola, Florida, big protest in Las Vegas, a large protest in Kansas City, in a country they thought they had on lock, that they would invent a wave of anti-Semitic hate attacks by misrepresenting and distorting video of scuffles between pro-Israel fanatics who were provoking or even physically assaulting Palestine Solidarity demonstrators in the streets of New York. And so what I did was basically analyze the video, show how it was deceptively edited, reveal, for example, that a young man who said he was attacked wearing a Jewish skull cap or a kippah in Midtown New York was not actually wearing one. The photos show him wearing a hoodie. There was no way of determining that he was Jewish, and showing that those Palestine Solidarity demonstrators who did attack him were actually being provoked and assaulted themselves prior to that. So the Israel lobby is trying to create the specter of anti-Semitism to paint the Jewish public as the ultimate victims of this brutal assault on the Gaza Strip. And at the same time, they're doing what they did in the UK, which is to fabricate or to paint Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the Labour Party, a veteran anti-racist, as a racist anti-Semite. But what they're doing is they're making us all Jeremy Corbyn. They're painting an entire movement as anti-Semitic in a bid to criminalize it. And it's important for people not to fall for it, because we see, like, progressives in Congress, including Ilhan Omar. We've seen Code Pink issue statements condemning the rise in anti-Semitism. And they are essentially condemning something that has been manufactured by an enemy that seeks to criminalize and remove them from public life. So it's important to call it out for what it is, to be clinical and forensic in analyzing these incidents. And that's what I've done at the Gray Zone and what we'll continue to do.
After 11 days of relentless bombings against Gaza, Israel claimed that it had emerged victorious. This is something that Israel always does for propaganda purposes, even when it's not true. One also wonders how it's possible to speak of victory when half the people Israel kills are not even combatants, but civilians. In 2006, during the war against Lebanon, the Israelis also claimed victory, even though Hezbollah sent them running with advanced weaponry and equipment provided by Iran. Maybe Netanyahu has been victorious in keeping his political rivals at bay and stopping any hopes of a coalition from happening without him, which would put an end to his 12-year rule. Now, he might hold on to power just a little bit longer because, of course, attacking Palestine is always an easy way to unite Zionists under one common banner and distract everyone from internal shortcomings like Netanyahu's corruption scandal or his inability to form a coalition. Now, Netanyahu's claims that he has set back Hamas or deterred them in any way are so outlandish that even other Israelis do not believe him. As history shows, Israel can only ever last a few days at war. It does not have the means to do anything else except maintain an illegal occupation. And this is true of almost every single conflict. Hamas was able to launch over 4,000 rockets, which reached as far as Tel Aviv. They were able to fire more rockets at a much higher rate and up to ranges of 250 kilometers. Their firepower is no joke, and it's thanks to Iran's support for the resistance that they're able to fend off Zionist aggression. Palestinians celebrated the ceasefire all over Gaza, flying flags and taking to the streets. And various Hamas officials thanked Iran for its unwavering support for Palestine and for the resistance. Public opinion worldwide has begun to shift. Hundreds of thousands of people have come out to protest in London. People took to the streets in support of Gaza all over the world, including France, Germany, Spain, Canada, and many more countries where we wouldn't have seen protests before. And although Western governments in general support Israel, The media's pro-Israeli narrative is beginning to lift, and more people are starting to see the reality behind what is happening in Palestine, that it's not just some random conflict, but an occupation. People see the disproportion in force. They see the wrath that Israel unleashes on Palestinians, and they know right from wrong. And in a first for Europe, Ireland's parliament passed a motion condemning the Israeli occupation and recognizing that its occupation of Palestinian land is a de facto annexation. So who emerged victorious from this 11-day assault? The Israelis think they did. And sure, if you think bombing roads and killing children and destroying infrastructure is winning, then yes, Israel won the war crimes contest. Israel claims that it dealt Hamas a huge blow. But this is just a safe face. Of course, Israel has a more advanced military and bigger bombs. And what does it do with those things? Military occupation and ethnic cleansing. You think that's something to be proud of? That's disgusting. And the Israelis know it's disgusting, which is why they spend so much time trying to hide their crimes from the world and using their lobby to silence criticism and cover up their occupation and war crimes in Palestine. If people knew what Israel does and understood the reality that Palestinians must live through, they would be mortified, and rightfully so. The Palestinian people have resilience, and they will never allow the Israelis to defeat them, whether in war or in occupation. Palestinians have never been on a level playing field. They have always been at a disadvantage, yet they resist. They do not have planes, tanks, ships, nor nuclear weapons, yet they resist. They are bombed, killed, oppressed, and massacred, yet they resist. Almost the entire world has abandoned Palestine, and yet they still resist. People need to understand something about Palestinians and the Middle East in general. You cannot beat people on their own home turf. At the end of the day, this occupation is taking place in Palestine. This is Palestinian land, and Palestinians will never give it up. They will fight to the death and even beyond because they know that what they fight for is sacred. They know the value of this earth, this land, their homes, their religions, their people, and their culture. They will not be defeated. The same for Yemenis, the same for Syrians, the same for Iranians and for Lebanese. This is why we talk about al-muqawame, the resistance, because we resist occupation and imperialism together. And no amount of Israeli propaganda or Western media lies will ever change that. So long as Palestine and Palestinians exist, then they are victorious. Israel will never win ultimately because it cannot defeat the Palestinian people and their resolve. Palestinians, along with Yemenis, Syrians, and many others in the Middle East, they all know what they fight for. They fight for their lives. They fight for their land. They fight for their homes. They fight for their families and their neighbors. They fight for their very right to exist. They know the real value and the worth of what lies beneath their feet. They do not have dual nationalities or two homes or the ability to go wherever they want, like the settler colonialists and Zionists who have come to occupy their land and shamelessly rob Palestinians of their homes. Palestinians do not have those luxuries or billions of dollars every year in military aid or the full backing of the West or the mainstream media to cover for them. For Palestinians, this is a matter of life and death. This is existential, and this is why they will never give up and why they can never be defeated. Thanks for tuning in. And long live the resistance. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran, for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. To all our brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You are listening to IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. The program is Islamic Upbringing, where we examine the problems that some parents may face while raising their children. To help us with that, we have Sheikh Ma'soumi, who has always been with us. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh Ma'soumi. Thank you for being with us once again.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. It's my pleasure to be here with you.
Thank you. So we're talking about teenagers here. That's a very sensitive part of every child's life. And on our last episode, we said that children, teenagers have this inclination to follow a trend, a lifestyle, a religion, and that we should be wary about this and be careful to use this opportunity. Have you seen any psychological studies on this issue as well?
Yeah. Almost most of the psychologists of the West, you know, they some of them I have studied, most of them they emphasize on the same thing which Islam emphasizes. Islam says that everybody, every newborn baby is created according to the fitratullah. We can say the nature,
innate,
yeah,
divine nature
of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So likewise, like that Quran says, فَأَقِمْ وَجْهَكَ لِلدِّينِ حَنِيفًا فِطْرَةَ اللَّهِ الَّتِي فَطَرَ النَّاسَ عَلَيْهَا. That the divine nature or the nature of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, according to that nature, all the human beings are created, you know. Like another hadith, the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam says, "Kullu mauludin yuladu ala al-fitra." Every newborn is born according to the fitra, the nature, divine nature. Hatta yakuna abawahu, unless his parents, his fathers and mothers, yuhawwidanihi aw yunassiranihi, they make them Jew, they make them Christian, they make them Muslim. Yeah. So according to Islam and according to the riwayat of the Prophet and Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, every human being is created, is born with the nature of, you know, divine nature. So I will give few examples, few sayings of the psychologist also. They also accept that all these newborn babies, new, you know, human beings, they are born with the fitra, with the pure fitra, with the pure nature. Although they don't say fitratullah, the divine nature, but they accept that they have this interest, this keen of religion in their nature. All the newborn babies. For example, Jean Piaget is a very famous psychologist of France. He says the religious issues, they find themselves very important in the age of teenagers, which again shows that this following a religion or following a lifestyle or following a divine religion is in their nature, in teenagers' nature. Likewise, another psychologist, Maurice Dubbs, you know, he says that religion is a very, very important part of every human being. Although they may neglect it, although they may forget it, but it is a very important part of every human being. So there are a lot of other psychologists, they emphasize that, you know, following a religion or to be a religious is in each human being's instinct,
okay,
nature.
Thank you. Yeah. We're going to take a break, and after the break we'll be back to further our discussion. Don't go away.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing. So just before the break, Sheikh Masumi, you quoted a few psychologists and their opinion about children's innate characteristics and nature. What verses and a hadith can you read for us on this topic?
Yeah, as I said, being a religious person or to follow a religion is in every human being's instinct, yeah, their nature. So as I presented, there are a lot of psychologists, Western psychologists, they also accept this, that to follow our religion, to follow our lifestyle, it is in every human being's, you know, nature. So there we have a lot of ahadith, we have a lot of riwayat, which also emphasize that this is the nature of Allah, the divine nature which have been instilled in each and every single human being. Let me share with you the beautiful hadith of Imam As-Sadiq, the sixth Imam, alayhi salam, where he says, الغلام يلعب سبع سنين ويتعلم الكتاب سبع سنين ويتعلم الحلال والحرام سبع سنين. In this hadith, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, when you have a child, first 7 years he plays. He does not care about anything else. Just he eats and plays. Okay. The second 7 years, يَتَعَلَّمُ الْكِتَابِ, he learns how to read and write. And the third 7 years, يَتَعَلَّمُ الْحَلَالَ وَالْحَرَامِ, means he learns what kind of things are halal and what kind of things are haram.
What kind of things are religiously allowed,
yeah,
permitted?
This, what does this mean? Permissible and non-permissible things, what does this mean? This means religion. What is religion? Religion means the guidelines, which things are halal for you and which things are not halal for you. Yeah? The summary of religion is halal and haram. That's why a lot of ahadith emphasize on this issue, that if you just do halal things and avoid from the haram things, then you will go to the Jannah. So this hadith also shows that our all the newborn babies, they have this nature, the fitratullah, the divine nature, and this is the parents, you know, who make them Jewish or Jews or Christians or Muslims or non-Muslims or atheists,
whatever.
Yeah, this is the food what parents provide with them. According to that food, they become.
Thank you very much. We're going to have to take a break here, but right after the break, we'll be back for more discussions. Don't go away.
Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam said, Allah will be merciful to his servant for his intense love for his child.
We're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing. We're trying to see some of the verses and narrations which are about the nature of people, of kids and teenagers. So we talked of one hadith by Imam Sadiq alayhi salam in the previous part. Can you share more of this kind of
if you hadith? Look at the life of the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam.